Buki Chukshing Me Tuk Chan Rirab Ling Shin Yen De Gen Padi Sanghe Shingdu Vik Te Uwagi Jokun Amdak Shing La Chupashu Idam Guru Radna Mandalakam Niryatayami Chudang Soki Choknam Lam Jamchu Vardu Dakni Kyapsuchi Daki Chenyen Gipe Sunam Ki Jola Penshir Sange Jupashu
Sange
Chudang Soki Choknam Lam Jamchu Bardu Dakni Kyapsuchi Daki Chenyen Gipe Sunam Ki Jola Penshir Sange Jupashu
Sange
Chudang Soki Choknam La
Jamchu
Bardu Dakni Kyapsuchi Daki chenyen gipe sunam ki Jola penchir sange jupashu And coming right into a meditation. And just starting out by feeling the weight of your body. Weight on your seat, the cushion, or the floor. And bring your attention to the crown of your head. And very leisurely, scanning down your body, stopping anywhere where there's a big spot or a knot of tension. And just letting your pure awareness release that tension. And it's not, so you may be switching gears from high activity to just sitting. So it's not as though you're going from reverse straight into drive. So you can let yourself relax and neutral and then come, I guess, maybe to park when you're ready without any struggle or force. And part of staying on the object of meditation is simply deciding to. I decide to be right here, scanning down my body. This is the most important thing right now. finish scanning down, switching directions and scanning up. And you can feel a brightening quality, but it's not agitating. It's not as though we just relaxed and released on the scan down, and then as we scan up, all that tension is back. So it's a bright, clear state, still relaxed, which is, for many of us, something we don't do that often. And then bring to mind the difficulties and the suffering that you see around you in the world. Thinking about all of these people that you see suffering as though they were your only child, each one of them. And it's almost as though they seem to be babies. They seem to be helpless, not able to claw their way out of whatever sadness or unhappiness is happening. And so it's just like that feeling that you would have for your only child who's very young. You can just think of one or two people or as many as you like. And looking at the suffering of the world as the world crying out for help. So you're hearing the cries of the world. And then out of that, in your own heart, arises this desire to help, to stop that. Backed by the knowledge that these vows that we are studying, that's the purpose. By following them, we'll be able to help all those beings that we're picturing. All the ones that we see every day in the news or living next to us at work. And so ending with this bright and fierce heart, deciding that that's what we're going to do. What else can there be to do in this life? And it's possible all of us will. take whatever energy and love that you've mustered through that meditation and make a dedication of your own. That little clock go.
Oh, I have it.
Oh, right. Let's see. Okay, so why don't we go around and just say how your practice is going in general. It can be with regards to the vows or just whatever comes up. You want to go first?
I think we're going to start that. It's going well, it's just that sometimes I forget. But I always come back. So, yeah, that describes kind of.
Yep, whatever you want.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to take this vows. But I have other vows too that I'm struggling with, like every day. But.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
I've been really busy, which has actually been good for my practice, I think, because I'm getting a lot of opportunity to see, like, how easy it is to go to refuge in other things. So that's been kind of like a nice contrast to the out of my usual routine, and see how easily, like, I can become really stressed and kind of just like start looking for happiness and other things.
Mm-hmm. I've really been aware of death and that it can come at any moment, and having a lot of fear surrounding my own death coming up. Which makes it kind of frustrating, I guess, to like care about things, but not like about dharma, but like, you know what I mean, like the drama at work or something like that, that like, you know, as part of my job I have to deal with, but it's like, I just don't care. So yeah, I guess figuring out how to make it dharma so I can like actually function in the world.
Yeah, my life has been really busy, and it seems like there are so many people in my close family and friend circle that have serious illness right now. And so seeing that suffering firsthand and struggling, you know, with not able to physically do anything, trying to work the practice and, you know, visualize helping, but then at the same time there's like that, is this really making a difference? You know, sometimes those, the doubts start coming up. And now I think I'm feeling a little bit stressed because there is so much going on in my life, and now there's like some more things that I want to try to accomplish in the next few weeks, and so not, you know, again, it's like not sure. It's like, okay, am I trying to take care of myself, or am I just, because I'm feeling overwhelmed, just trying to escape into something else? So, but feeling very good that I'm now at 56 straight days of meditating. It hasn't been perfect, and a lot of the days it's only been about maybe 5 minutes or so, 5 to 7 minutes, but. But almost every day I do the preliminaries and the dedication. So,
awesome.
So I'm feeling very, very thrilled about that.
We should have like buttons that people wear or something.
Yeah, and you get to like.
But yeah, we're not supposed to think, well, I'm better because I've made it this many days.
No, but you're an inspiration to other people. Like, oh, people are actually doing this.
I'm like, thing we talk about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, retreat really did inspire me on that. So ever since retreat, yeah. I've continued.
That's good. Yeah, it's really helpful for, like, jump-starting practice. Yeah. Cool. I'm really excited for the vow ceremony. I love vow ceremonies. And we haven't had one.
Almost
I don't know. Is that when it was? It was 2 years ago?
Right? Yeah, April and May.
Oh, yeah, it'll be just about a year.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yay, I'm excited. Okay, so let's do our little review. I think by now you guys can probably just tell me the answers without me asking. okay, so what's the main text that we're studying?
Highway for Bodhisattvas.
Yes.
Jetsun Kapa.
Yep. And you know his dates?
1365.
1419.
Yep. And do you know the Tibetan?
Shenlong.
Yep. Jiangchu Shenlong. And then what's the other text that's like the more succinct presentation of the vows?
Strings.
Yep. String of Shining Jewels. And who's that one by?
Geshem.
Sancho.
Yep. Geshe Sewang. Samdrup. And then what's the Tibetan?
Norbai Uchan.
Yep. Good job.
Can you repeat that, please?
Norbai Uchan?
I don't really know the pronunciation. I say Norbai Uchan.
U-T-R-E-N-G.
So tonight we're going over the secondary vows. It is Wednesday, February 21st, and we're going over the secondary vows, number 1 through 16. So we finished the root vows. So say Nyeje.
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 And that's the name of the secondary transgressions or secondary vows, secondary downfalls. So we finished how many root vows?
18.
Yes. 18 root vows. And what's the difference between these and the other 18?
What happens when you break them?
Mm-hmm. So what'd you say the difference is?
When you break them, like where you end up?
Partly, yes. And what you can do when you break them.
Mm.
too. So you can restore these vows. The root 18, when you've destroyed them, do you guys remember what happens?
Yeah,
and in this life, what happens?
You're not able to see emptiness directly.
Under the influence of?
Bodhicitta,
yes. So you're not able to do that in this life, which is the first Bodhisattva Bhumi. So when you destroy those first 18, can you take them over?
I'm sorry, say that again.
When you destroy those first 18, can you take them over?
Next life. I guess you can.
You can. You can take them over, but they're not going to be as strong as they were to begin with. You've still completely broken them, and they'll never be back to where they are in this life. With these secondary vows, you can. You can restore them. So that's good. And if we remember from the first 18, they're really hard to break. So you have to have all these different parts there when you break them. It's not like what they appear to be. So that's why it's good to study them like this and then go back over and look over them again. I need to go back and look over again too. Even after studying it again to prepare for class and then teaching it. Still, it's a lot to remember. So you can restore these secondary vows if you've broken them by confessing to another person, and the other person does need to be Buddhist. So you can break the vows in an afflicted way or a non-afflicted way, which means what?
When you're under the influence of
affliction. Mm-hmm. Like, what's an example? Hard to get out of this.
is it
like an example of an affliction that you would be under?
Yeah, anger.
Mhm. And then non-afflicted, you wouldn't have like anger or jealousy or bless you, or like hatred or something like that. It would be more like you forgot or you were lazy. I'm not really sure what he means when he says lazy. Because I feel like there could be a lazy way where you're like, I don't care. And that seems to be kind of afflicted. But maybe it's just laziness, as in you're not paying attention or something like that. What were you going to say?
I was going to give another example. Getting angry and say, I don't believe in this, and that's it. I'm done with this, right?
Yeah.
Where I get stuck with me.
Yes, that would be a bad thing. So for it to be breaking one of that one bodhisattva vow, you would say, like, I give up helping all of living beings. I'm not doing that anymore. That's that one of the two that we talked about, where you break it immediately. Doesn't have to have all the other factors. And then the other one is wrong worldview, which would also be like what you're saying too.
So ignorance, like wrong worldview, would be considered here mental affliction?
Would wrong worldview be considered a mental affliction?
Because it seems like if you're not angry, but you're doing it out of laziness, like part of the laziness would be like, oh, it doesn't really work this way, or it's okay this time, or
I think that would be laziness, but I don't think that wrong worldview is necessarily a mental affliction. Because we have wrong worldview all the time. I can't say for sure that it's not, but because I could see it either way. Either it's like the main mental affliction and it just permeates everything, but then that wouldn't make sense because then we'd be screwed. Like everything would be a mental affliction.
Yeah.
Okay. So there wouldn't be the option of non-afflicted, and there is. So that would lead me to believe that wrong worldview isn't one. But it's just kind of the permanent state of our mind. Because you could have wrong worldview and be like very kind and loving towards someone. Because we do that all the time. All right. Let's go to the next slide. Okay. So this is the first. And the first seven vows are against the perfection of giving. So who knows, who can list the six perfections? The first one
giving.
I just said. Mm-hmm.
Wisdom.
That's the sixth one. Mm-hmm.
Ethical life.
Mm-hmm.
Patience.
Yep.
Not getting angry. Right?
Yep. Not getting angry. Good.
Concentration.
Mm-hmm.
Good
love,
right?
Yep.
Good love, right? Good concentration.
Yes. And then I feel like we listed seven.
Compassion.
No, I was thinking we listed seven.
Yeah, giving, ethics, patience, joyful effort, concentration, wisdom.
Yep. Okay.
A couple twice. The most important ones.
So these first seven are against the perfection of giving. Okay, the first perfection. And the first one is not to offer the three to the three jewels. Okay, so what does the three mean here? The three here means body, speech, and mind. It's not referring to the three times a day. And at a minimum, each day you must do some physical reverence to the three jewels. Bow, prostrate, etc. Just any kind of reverence physically. That's
you
the first
that
one.
Every day.
Yep, that's what this one says. And this is, so if you have like if you have a morning meditation practice, or even if it's just like a few minutes, I do prostrations every day before and after that, and then it covers it. Or if, I think if you had a yoga practice, sun salutations, you could have that intention with the forward fold, like when you're coming up to stand and then forward fold. Verbally, you must say a minimum of four lines about the three jewels. So say something good about them. The Buddha jewel is your enlightened self. The Dharma jewel consists of the direct perception of emptiness, spiritual realizations, and cessation of mental afflictions. And cessation in Buddhism means reaching a permanent state where you will never have a bad thought again. I don't know if that's how we usually think of that word, but that's what it means when you hear it in Buddhism. So when you see the direct perception of emptiness, you'll have a cessation where you will never think the teachings aren't true again. You'll never have any doubt about them. You'll never think that things are self-existent. And so these are the real dharmas. It's not referring to the books and that sort of thing. So basically you're praying to a condition, which would be the real protection, not to a person or something like that. And then there's the Sangha jewel. Are those who have perceived emptiness directly. So you can think of all of the teachers, all of the masters, all the practitioners who came before, who are here now, who have seen emptiness directly, whoever you know of or think has, who's still living, anyone in like the close past, all of the beings that are on the tankas around. So that's who you're bowing to with the Sangha. All those who have seen emptiness directly.
Question. So
mm-hmm.
once I take the vows and start, do I have to how you say this? Do I have to every morning say I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and prostrations? Would that cover this? Okay.
Yeah, body, speech, and then mind, I think, while you're doing the prostrations, if you're thinking of what they mean, I think that would cover it. Body, speech, and then in the mind. But you probably cover it in your mind throughout the day anyways, just thinking about teachings here and there.
Okay.
But it does specifically say to the three jewels. So as you're doing your prostrations, you can think, I'm bowing to my enlightened self, my understanding of emptiness, and those who have seen emptiness. And so you're doing the body and the mind in one. Yeah. And then yeah, so you could also, if you have like some text or mantras or something like that, you could say those. It just says something good about the three jewels. So saying something good about them. It's best, I think, if it's something that you don't have to physically read, that you can just memorize or that you already know. So you can do it wherever you are and you don't have to have anything with you. Then, like, if you forget a book or something like that, you're not, like, unable to do it. And usually, also, keeping your six-time-a-day book will cover it, too. Yeah. So, going for refuge means, does anyone remember the actual definition of going for refuge?
I think it's in class 1 or course 1. Yeah, it'll come to me, but I don't know.
It's basically, I don't know if I have the exact definition off the top of my head, but it's basically, you remember?
Yeah.
Good.
Just like pop. Thinking day and night about, I don't know if it's the suffering and wanting to get out of it. So all that's on your mind is how much you want to get out of the suffering.
That one is renunciation.
Oh,
that is what renunciation is. And refuge is just like going to something other than yourself, thinking, putting all of your hope in the fact that it can help you. So the teachings, going for refuge to your understanding of emptiness, karma, to, you can think of the three jewels, thinking, going for refuge to enlightened self, I will be enlightened one day. That is the progression for me. I know that's true, and so that's going to, like, fuel my practice now. Going for refuge to my understanding of emptiness, which is going to be the thing that's going to protect me and plant the seeds until I see emptiness directly. And then going for refuge to just the fact that I know that there's been all of these beings before me who have done this, who have walked this path, who have reached the goal. And maybe even, you don't know for sure, but you have a strong suspicion that it's true. So just that idea, and then that these teachings are what got all of these people where they're going. It's what's going to get me where I'm going to. So I'm going for refuge to the teachings, to my understanding of the teachings, that sort of thing. And so in order for us to see emptiness directly, we have to be meditating. Geshe Michael says different amounts of time throughout different courses. I don't know where he's landing on it right now, but in this course he says at least an hour a day. And I can say over time your meditation will just build up to that. You don't have to try to force it. You want to keep your meditation where you like doing it and where it's sweet. But if you do it every day, even if you start with 2 minutes a day, it will build up on its own over time. And an hour won't be that much. It'll just be what you do every morning. And then it'll keep building. Like, I think His Holiness, I think he does 4 hours of practice a day.
4 hours?
Mm-hmm. And probably parts of it are, like, reading a text or something like that. Well, he probably has it all memorized, but, you know, it's not all, like, single-pointed focus, but, for him it might be. But, yeah, you just work up over time, and it'll gradually start to increase on its own. Just when you're ready, it'll start increasing more and more. So it's not something that you have to push. It's just you keep doing it all the time and you don't stop doing it. And then it'll take care of itself. And you just have to get to that point where you're doing it every single day. No matter if all you can get yourself to do is just sit down on your cushion and then you get up. Just starting to plant the seeds to where you'll have that daily, really strong practice where it doesn't matter what happens. Like, I remember in Italy, I had, like, this horrible shoulder pain. And I went to the hospital, and I was waiting to see the doctors. And as I was sitting there with, like, that horrible shoulder pain, I still did my practice while I was sitting there. So it's like getting to that point where it doesn't matter, you just do it. It doesn't matter if you're tired. It doesn't matter even if you're drowsy. You fight it. And there's different views on that. For me, I just try to fight it. I do whatever I can, and I still do my practice. I don't get up, and I don't stop. Some people have different ideas and, you know, their own personal practices in their life, but for me, it's the consistency that just keeps it going and keeps it going. So all of us can do it. It's just a matter of starting. And we'll have to do it at some point because that's our trajectory, all of us, to reach Buddhahood, if you're not already there. And the only way we're going to do that is through meditation. So we'll have to do it at some point, and we might as well just do it now instead of waiting.
Heather, is that considered a continuous amount of time? So, like, 1 hour continuous?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
because sometimes I'll do more than one session.
It doesn't have to be. No, it can be a few different sessions. I think it just depends how much you can focus in those different sessions. Yeah, because for some people it'll work better to split it up into smaller sessions. And for others it'll be better to have just one, just depending on your schedule too during the day if things get carried away as your day goes on, or if you have the space and the time. So yeah, it can be separate sessions.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, it can change through time too. It doesn't have to look the same all the time. So just because it looks like one session for like 5 years, maybe then it changes, or for 2 months or whatever. So I think it's okay to be a little relaxed with that, but very, in a way you have to be like very strict and diligent with yourself to get to your cushion, and then when you're there, you're relaxed and you're soft in a way, and you're also very strict keeping your mind there. Because we can train the mind very quickly if we're Well, I guess that's debatable. But if we're very strict with it in a way, and we're not just deciding to wander to every object that goes by, bless you, because it's a choice, and at a certain point, we realize it's a choice, and then we just decide, I'm not doing that. I'm here meditating. I decided to do this, and that's what I'm doing. I don't even care about every little thing that goes by. It's not that, you know, it's not that exciting. This is better. And I decided I'm sitting here meditating. I might as well just do it. Bless you. Okay. So let's go to the next one. Okay. So probably none of us can relate to this one, but we'll go over it anyways. So number two, to allow improper thoughts of desire to go on. All right. I actually haven't heard of this text that Geshe-la mentions. So these are coming from Chandra Gomi's 20 Verses on Morality. And so he says, if you want to memorize something to keep your vows, this is what most people use. I haven't read it. I'm interested in that, though. I wonder if we even have it here. Yes, we're going to. So improper means that you have a state of mind which is never satisfied with what you have. Nothing's ever good enough. It always has to change in some way. You have excessive sensual desires, attachment to others praising you, attachment to people knowing who you are, attachment to recognition, attachment to having like specific things for dinner or for lunch or breakfast, otherwise all hell breaks loose, you know, in your household. Something like that. So it's thoughts of things you would like to own, something you want to eat. Basically, most of all the thoughts that go through our mind, I think, if your mind's anything like mine. Or thoughts of just being in a rush for really no good reason. I do this a lot. And then getting upset with someone who's taking too long in front of me at the grocery store. Like the desire, I wish you weren't here right now. Something like that. I think that plays into it too. Really just a state of mind where we never allow ourselves to be satisfied with what we have. And then if we're never satisfied with what we have, we're planting the seeds to never be satisfied with what we have, and we're never going to be satisfied with what we have. So it's not like it's just going to switch at some point. We have to have the seeds for it to switch. And being unsatisfied with what's happening in the present doesn't change it. It actually makes it more uncomfortable and like an unhappier situation. So it's better to try to at least practice like distancing ourselves from that all the time. And maybe at first just noticing it. And it happens, like, everything is permeated with this. Partly because it's samsara, but also partly because we're perpetuating it. Like, just because it comes up, it doesn't mean we're replanting the seed. The dissatisfaction can come up, and we don't have to plant it again. We don't have to think, yeah, this sucks. I got this sandwich, and it's not as good as last time. There's, like, a little more pesto on my serious salami sandwich from Pushkin's. And I'm not happy with it. So it's like that. We do that all the time. Through everything. And what would it be like if we were able to let it go? Because there's also all the deliciousness in the sandwich that I'm ignoring because I'm focusing on the fact that there's not enough of the sauce or there's too much of the sauce or... Like, it's just so annoying. If you heard someone else talking about it, what was going on in our own head, we'd be like, oh my God, you're so annoying. We probably do think that about people when we think the same thing. And then it's things, thoughts of things you'd like to own. I do this one. I remember when I was a kid making lists of things that I wanted to buy. Like, that's the culture that we live in. And maybe you weren't, like, as extreme as that. But still, I still have, like, a running list of things that I need in my mind. Not real, and I don't really need them, but it's this list of things that I want to get. And it's never ending. It really is never ending. There's always something else added on. I'm never done, never, because that's the, you know, that's the endless wheel of suffering, and that's the wheel that consumer capitalism keeps us on. So nothing's ever good enough. We're trained to think that since we were very small, so it's a hard thing to overcome. And we can do it. Okay. So, like we said before, though, is it breaking a bodhisattva vow to have these thoughts?
No, if you stop.
Right. It's not breaking a vow to have the thought, because the thought comes up from what? Yeah, so it's a seed ripening from the past. And in a way, it's just like this innocent energy coming up that has this label. And then we grab onto it again and we think, yeah, this situation really sucks in the present. I don't like it. I'm unhappy. And then we planted the seed again. With it coming up, it's just like, it's just coming up. That's it. So all we have to do is just not follow it. And it's not that easy a lot of times, but sometimes it is. Sometimes it's just little things that we don't even pay attention to. And if we stop doing all those little things, it adds up to a big thing. So there's also, if we let it go on without fighting it, then that's when we're breaking the vow. Just riding along and not to struggle against it. Just keep going along with it. So even if we put up any kind of wimpy, tiny struggle, and then we end up doing whatever negative thing we're going towards, we don't break the vow. If we put up a struggle, we talked about this before with a few other vows. So you just have to put up some kind of little struggle. And then you won't break the vow.
Today I was driving home and I took the wrong exit. So I took my phone and I was trying to, you know, the GPS, but the GPS wasn't working. So I was like this, the wheel. And then I realized, oh my God, I'm getting angry at the phone. So I break the phone. And, you know, I'm not gonna be home. And at that precise moment, just started working, so I just left. But I think those things happen all the time.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
And, yeah, maybe it was like your little bit of insight that then allowed the seed to come up for the phone to work again.
Yeah, probably, basically,
yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't like... crazy.
Yeah, I remember Gilik Rinpoche, who was he's a teacher in our lineage who's passed away now, but I remember him saying that the more technology we have, the more anger there will be in the world. And I think that's so true. It really stuck with me, and I see it all over the place. Like, I feel it myself, too, because I don't know what it is. It's like there's this annoyance with these things, like with the phones and the computers, because it's like you feel like you're out of control and it can just do whatever it wants. But I don't know if that's what it is, but there's something about interacting with the screen all the time that I feel in my own body and my own mind brings up anger. I don't know what's happening. I don't know why it's like that.
But you know, I also think it's inevitable. Like, I mean, we have to just embrace it and just keep going and see how we're going to handle that anger towards the technology, because there's no way to stop it. It's just, it's going to be more technology. Like, you know, time goes by, we're going to have to figure out amazing things. But, I mean in the sense of technology.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, because I was thinking also about my daughter, because she loves to grab my phone and just play with it on the computer, and every technology she's like, and today I was like, no, you know, you stop it, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets angry, and she starts crying and all that, but you got to be firm, and then later on, just 1 hour or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's her generation. She grew up with, I grew up running and getting dirty and just, you know, just playing outside. But right now, it's so different.
It's like an app of running outside.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Let's go running.
Like, let's run
outside. We went hiking this weekend, and she was, like, really happy. Like, she was, like, she embraced it, like, yeah, let's go. And then Sunday, she was like, are we going hiking again? Mm. So I think we're going to do it, like.
Yeah, that's so great.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's about managing your whatever devices
yeah.
you have, as opposed to letting them manage you. Like, every time a notification comes up, oh, I go to my phone. Oh, it's calling me again. Oh, you know, like, every single time, it's about managing how we interact with these things. And taking a break, I think, too. Because it can't make us be online unless you implant a chip in your mind, which I think, I don't know if it's possible now, but it will happen.
The what? Yeah.
I think
sure,
there is something
sure.
now. Yeah.
I kind of think there might be, too.
Well,
yeah,
there's
yeah.
something,
yeah.
There's already there.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, I think they're doing it, though, mostly to help, like,
yeah.
veterans and those that, you know, to connect.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if they can do it for that, to connect your muscles to
yeah.
the brain, then you can.
Oh, my God. What happens if
anything?
It malfunctions? Like, you could have people murdering people or something.
Murder
malfunction?
I think it was actually a TV episode of something like that that I saw again.
All those sci-fi movies, they could come true, because you have no idea how it malfunctions. It could, like, lodge in some part of your brain
that
causes some reaction.
In the future, they were already talking about, you know, planting something in your eye.
Yeah.
By the way, can we just get ourselves to really think?
So, okay, as we were saying, any effort at all to prevent it will prevent you from breaking the vow. So desire becomes excessive when you're willing to do something wrong to fulfill it. So I think that's a good guideline to know. Okay. So as we said, the structure here is that we're going through the six perfections, and we're still on giving. So these vows that we're doing now, they ruin our perfection of giving. So you can kind of see, especially the energy of this one, is like not having enough. So you're not giving. You're just like, I need more, I need more, I need more. Should we do one more? okay, we'll do this one and then we'll go. We'll take our break. Yeah, that'd be good. This one's short. So this one is not respecting elders. Which, what do you think it means by elders? Does anyone have an idea?
Anyone older than me.
Kind of.
Well, the ill people sometimes too, or not?
They could be ill. Do you know Belinda?
No, parents. Your teacher.
It's what it's referring to, which you guys wouldn't know unless you studied the Bodhisattva vows already. Which you did, right? Elders are someone who took the Bodhisattva vows before you, So it doesn't matter what age they are. They could be way younger than you. And when you become a monk, one of the most important parts of the ceremony is that someone records the time that you took your vows. Because after that, throughout the whole world, whoever takes their vows after you, they have to respect you. Basically, in the monastery, if you're making tea, you offer the tea to them first. When they walk in the room, you stand up. So you pay respect to those who have taken the bodhisattva vows before you. So it's the same as the monastery with this vow. That's what it is. And, you know, you do it in an appropriate way, not a way that's maybe awkward for people who don't know the vows, or not at an inappropriate time, like in the middle of a teaching or something like that, but in ways where you can, honoring those people. Whether, I mean, you have to know that they've taken the vows.
Elderly people.
Only that.
Only that, okay.
Yeah. Only those who have taken the bodhisattva vows before you.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay if we don't respect the...
yeah.
And you that.
Okay. Yeah, that one takes a very short amount of time. Okay, so let's take a break. Does anybody have any questions on anything? Any of the vows up to this point, or anything that's like doesn't feel finished? I don't feel anything on this, but it's like gripping onto this. Or you can ask practice questions or anything if you want, or we can just wait for it to start too.
So, may I ask who has taken the bodhisattva vows here? I know you can probably do that.
The bodhisattva vows?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
No?
I don't think any of them have.
Mm-hmm.
Except for Heather.
Okay.
That's why we're all here.
Have all of you, I know you've asked. Have you asked on me?
Yes, I have, but haven't asked three times, so...
Okay.
Yeah, I've only asked once.
Okay. And you were going to ask?
I haven't asked yet.
Okay.
I sent a follow-up email, and in it, I actually asked three times in a row.
Yeah, you can do that.
Cover it. But yep. Then I also said that, you know, because I didn't know if the answer might still be the same as before, that since I hadn't taken the initial vows and had, you know, several years of practice... You know, so I still haven't officially gotten an answer on the bodhisattva vows yet.
In regards to
whether or not I can take.
So I believe what she said is that she's going to offer, give you the first vows first, and then the bodhisattva vows.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
In the same ceremony. It's okay. Maybe hasn't been communicated, okay. But that's what she mentioned.
I'm meeting with Ryan on Friday, but other than that.
Yeah, he's going to go over those vows with you, and then she'll give you both of them. That's the plan.
So I remember in the photos, it looked like everybody was wearing like light colored. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to go out and find an outfit.
It's nice to have like a special outfit that you wear or something like that. It's traditionally all white.
Yeah. Okay. So what vows are you talking about?
The refuge and. Lay vows.
Okay. So we have to take all of them? Because I think I have only taken the layman vows.
You didn't... I don't think... You didn't take the refuge vows? I thought you did. No?
Okay. I may have, but I don't remember exactly which one is which. But I...
Okay. Because I know I was at your vow ceremony, but I think everybody was taking refuge vows. It would be unusual to have just taken the lifetime lay vows.
Maybe I'm confused. But I'll double check because I have to.
Because sometimes people take the refuge vows but not the layperson vows, right?
But maybe it's the other way around. Yeah,
maybe so maybe you took refuge.
Yeah.
And are the layperson vows, I read this recently, are they just for the day? Like you take them daily?
There are ones that you can take for a day, but the ones that you get this during the ceremony or the lifetime for like this lifetime. Yeah. So good to figure out.
Yes. I'll figure it out tonight.
And then so if you haven't, it sounds like Jenny and Ryan are meeting up. So if you still need to take them, you could meet up with them and go over them.
The last thing was Friday after 2:30, so we're kind of
okay.
So when I find out, and I mean, you may want to just message. I'm thinking, Mama, me, just to mention, because she was looking to see if there was anybody else who was interested in doing it. So that would
now.
Know.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll do that. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fine. Let's keep going.
I think you probably took your refuge vows. I'm pretty sure that's what the ceremony was. How many years ago was that?
That was like 2.5, probably 3 years maybe.
Okay. I think so. I'm pretty sure you took your refuge vows. You didn't take the no intoxicant vows?
I found out that you don't have to take that one. That's why I didn't take that
one. Okay.
That's the only one I didn't take.
So then I think she gave the lifetime lay to some people without the no intoxicant. But yeah, check with her.
I mean, if I have to take it, I'll take it.
I think you already did, but we can talk about it.
No, I mean that vow in particular, because I know that vow I'll take.
Oh, okay.
And I think talked about this, you said no intoxicant primarily just means alcohol. So like if we have a prescription medication that might make us drowsy or something, that's not necessarily considered.
Right. Well, you can't go out and do like a lot of ecstasy or or smoke a lot of weed every day and get really high.
The doctor said I can't take this right now.
But yeah, it's referring to mostly drugs and alcohol, but not in the sense of I'm taking medication for pain or for something like that. And I mean, I haven't taken all medications, but when I've had surgery in the past and took like Vicodin, when it was for the pain, I didn't feel anything else from it. It just got rid of the pain.
Yeah.
So I think when you're taking it for what you're supposed to be taking it for, unless you're taking too much, it's not like affecting you in the same way too. So it's basically the point of it is it's not going to make you break your vows. Like drinking a bunch and getting really drunk.
Intoxicated and then have wild behavior.
Right. I mean, like we all know what happens sometimes when you do that, so that's the point.
Yeah. So yeah, Lamami told me that it affects your practice when you like your meditation and all that stuff. So you need to be clear-minded.
Right. Yeah.
So what about Buddhists who do drink?
They just haven't taken that vow.
Okay.
Or they just the vow. Like, cause,
yeah. And they're just not following
it.
I
didn't take that vow.
Yeah.
I just feel like I've known people who've taken the vow but there's like they don't drink a lot. I don't know, but like I feel like I'm missing something.
I know, it's confusing because there's...
Or Geshe, the Naropa Geshe, or Rinpoche maybe.
I didn't much on him.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that, it's hard to say with someone else's practice what it is. With him, what I've heard, I mean, there's all different options. Like, number one is he's completely breaking his vows all the time. That's one option. Another option is that it's skillful means. Like he's, and I've heard of people saying, students of his, I never would have been attracted to Buddhism. Other, you know, except for the parties that he would throw. And then there've been practitioners for like decades or something like that. So it could be either. And I don't really know which one it is. So that part is, it's confusing to me too sometimes.
And also when you're enlightened, you basically can do whatever you want, right?
It's not going to affect you that way.
Uh-huh, exactly, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it won't affect you that way when you're enlightened.
And ultimately, everyone drinking around us that took the vow is just a projection of our mind, and so that's not even self-existently breaking the vow.
Yeah, the thing is, we don't know who they really are. They could be an enlightened being who are trying to help us, who are trying to teach us something. It is possible. And on another level, they might just be breaking their vows. I've taken my no intoxicant vows. And that's one that I have never broken, not even once. I mean, like, wrong worldview, I break that all the time. You know, I just do. It's just how my mind works at this point in time. But that one, for me, that's one that I can do, and I never break that one because I know I can do it. And some people can't do it. Some people have problems with alcohol in that way. Like, it's not that they're an alcoholic, or, but, you know, like, they can't give it up like that. Yeah. So, honestly, for me, I'm pretty judgmental of people when I see them breaking that one, because I'm like, come on, like, that's, I mean, there's other ones, of course, you're going to break, but that one? But I really can't judge, because I don't know. It might be one that they, like, cannot overcome, and maybe they're fighting against it and trying not to, and sometimes they, like, give in. I don't know. But that one's troubled me for a while, because I see a lot of people I took my vows with drinking.
I've seen that too.
Yeah. That one is, I think it's just a confusing one. Because it's like, what's happening here? Why is this happening? And I don't know, like a good place to come down on it is, I don't know if I've found a really good place to come down on it, but maybe there's some other purpose for what they're doing. It's possible. It's also possible, like Gelug Rinpoche, he used to drink, and he said it didn't affect him. Like, he didn't feel the effects of the alcohol. So it's different for him. Because the point of the vow, it doesn't say no alcohol, although the Buddha did say that, but the reason he made that vow is because there's people who misbehaved and ruined it for everybody, and so now he made the vow and nobody can do it. So I know, I find that one confusing too, because it's also like, it seems like some people are like so obvious about breaking it too. I'm like, posting on Facebook about this? Like, I don't get it. But that's really the point. I really just don't know.
But the only reason you can see people breaking their vows now is because you were breaking your vow in the past very publicly, or maybe less publicly, but because it grows. But, like, yeah.
Yeah, so we all have the seeds to see that. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I guess, too, we could look at it as like a purification opportunity. And it might not be that I did exactly what I'm seeing, or that any of us did exactly what we're seeing. It might be more like, what's the feeling that's coming up for me right now? And how have I made other people feel that way? And usually for me, it's like, it's mostly like, what the hell? It's mostly like confusion, and kind of, it like touches in for me on like need for order. and yeah, for order. Mm-hmm. Like there's these rules and we follow them. That's what it is for me. Yeah. So I agree. I think that one's a tricky one. Okay. So we're done with that one. Number four, this one's hard, I think, too. I'm on the wrong slide, though. No, I'm not. Okay, so number four is not answering a question. And we all do this, I think. This means either not answering a question or giving an inadequate answer to any question, not just a Dharma question. I do this a lot. I have a really bad habit of this. Like I'll say, I kind of like want people to know what I'm talking about without really saying it. And then people just end up confused. And then there's miscommunication. They don't know what I'm talking about most of the time because it doesn't make sense. So that would be this. Yeah. So it's just a diss of other people to do that. Like you don't turn to them and address their question. Or you joke around and you never answer the question. And I was thinking about all those annoying requests for surveys that I get in my email. I don't like doing those. But I was like, that might be a little bit of like just not answering a question. Because they're blatantly asking me to do something, and I'm just not.
So you basically have to attend every question that somebody asks you, like.
For the most part. So there are exceptions.
Like thinking, like somewhere, like I tend to be distracted. Like I think of many things, and then somebody asks you, and you're like.
Yeah, well, that's answering, though, if you're saying what? So, and that's the thing, like, the Bodhisattva vows, it's like they're training us to now think of other people and to be caring and kind towards them. And usually we're used to the opposite most of the time, you know? So the exceptions for this one and for the last. Yeah, and for the last one, they're the same. So the not respecting your elders one. Exceptions are if you're sick or you're asleep or groggy, if you're teaching and it interrupts the flow, or if you want to teach a lesson. So that is only with Bodhisattva motivation. That's the only reason to teach a lesson one. So we can't all go around teaching people lessons all the time just because we don't feel like answering a question. You don't break it if someone asks you a question during a Dharma talk and you know it would distract you. You just say, no, not right now. And you see teachers doing this. So going back to the last one, if honoring the elder, the person who took their Bodhisattva vow before you, if that would distract a Dharma teaching and it would disrupt the class, then you don't do it. And we kind of mentioned that before. But if you know with the honoring the elder, if you know that that person has a problem with pride, if you decide not to get up because it would help them reflect on their pride, then you don't break it. But you have to be very careful with that. If you're angry and you just don't want to respond, that's for sure breaking the vow. It doesn't mean that you, I don't think it means that you have to talk about what the person's asking you about, but it just, my thought of it, it just means ignoring them, not answering. So it doesn't mean that like if they're asking you something and you're uncomfortable talking about it right now, that you can't say, you know, I'm not comfortable talking about this right now. Could we talk about later? Something like that. It's not meaning that you have to do whatever they're questioning you or asking you about. But you can't ignore them. Bernardo doesn't like this one. This one's hard, I think. Yeah.
You have a lot of questions.
Yeah.
And some of them don't always seem appropriate.
You know,
my opinion.
I was actually trying to understand it because it seems that all the vows are aimed to corner all the emotions we have. Control and like afflicted emotions, right? So this is kind of like not being, trying not to be like cocky.
Yeah. I think that's what it is.
Like
yeah,
or
your time's more important than
someone
else's question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like I'm, yeah, I'm too important to answer this, or like that question's below me or something like that.
Or like my Facebook newsfeed is like way more important than me right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to close all that and really, I'm going to move to that mountain. How's everybody?
Then the squirrels are like knocking on your door asking
questions. And this would be a challenge, I think, with kids.
Because
they ask so many questions all the time.
I'm not in that
yes. Why? Why?
She's not there yet because she's got two languages, so it takes a little bit more time to
oh, good.
Start talking.
Add like another language in there,
yeah,
and then she'll
yeah.
never
yeah.
get
yeah.
there.
No, not 6 months.
That's cool that she's learning two languages. That
Guando.
Guando. Oh, I know. She's starting already. Like,
yeah, this one, I think it seems harder than it. Than it actually is when you're practicing with it. Yeah. And so just thinking like it's a kindness to answer someone's question. Like think about when someone doesn't answer a question that you've asked. Because every time you ask a question in a way, you're kind of like putting yourself out there. And when someone doesn't answer, there's just a sadness. I feel that every time. It doesn't even matter the reason. There's just some little sadness that comes along with it. Like they could not hear me and, you know, someone else is listening and we both realize that they can't hear me or, you know, they're busy or they didn't even register. But still there's like some sadness or like some rejection. There's something that's there. So that's what other people are feeling when we're not answering them.
Yeah, their confidence also goes down. Asking questions like they don't have a kind of like this. You get like that.
So, okay. And then the next one. Not to accept a sincere invitation. And this is just exactly what it says. If someone invites you to their home, you have to go. Has to be out of pride, anger, or laziness that you don't.
What if they're doing something that breaks the vow?
There are exceptions.
Like a beer. Can I invite you for?
There are exceptions. So, exceptions are that you're sick, that you've already accepted another invitation. It doesn't count if you make up another invitation that you're going to do in place of it. You have to have already accepted it. It's too far or dangerous to go. You're invited out of a bad motive to teach a lesson if you're a very high bodhisattva. That one is an exception. If it diverts you from a virtuous act. So, but if they're sincere, you have to go. It doesn't matter if you like them. It doesn't matter if you want to hang out with them. Because you're now in bodhisattva training. So you're a bodhisattva now. And it's like your only child is asking you to do something. Because it's a kindness. It's a kindness to say yes when people ask you to do something. And it's never, like following this one, nothing bad has ever happened with me. I mean, yeah, if it's something like, so it says it's too far or dangerous to go. So if it's something that's not going to be safe, then that's an exception. But an example of this, where I I thought of this vow and I knew I was keeping this vow by going. There was a guy at work who invited me to a Christmas party he was having. And he invites a bunch of people at work. But I thought he invited everyone on my team, and I mentioned it to other people and they weren't invited, which was awkward. But but then it made it even more clear, like, okay, he did actually specifically invite me. And, you know, he's paying for this whole party at his house, and he's inviting people. And so it's a kindness to go. Like, when you plan a party and you invite people, you want them to come. And when they say no, you know, if nobody shows up, it's a really sad thing. So out of kindness and thinking of this bodhisattva vow, I did not want to go. And it was kind of far, too. It was in Rockland. But I did. I went, and I stayed for... I didn't stay that long. I was going to go up to my parents' house after. And I went for maybe, like, 45 minutes or something like that. Maybe an hour. And then I left. But I purposely did that because I thought of this vow. And so... You know, it's a big good deed to do that every time you do. And I was thinking, what if you end up marrying someone named Jacob? That would be crazy.
Because of the
class.
Yeah. My grandma, she always is like, ugh, people are always inviting me to lunch, inviting parties. And they want me to hang out. And I'm just like, yeah, grandma's, like, a terrible life. Like, people are like, you have a loving family. And, like, we threw a party for her last year. And I was like, yeah, it's a terrible life to have, like, a loving family who's trying to throw you a party. And, like, people who want to hang out with you when you're 91. Like,
yeah.
She just want to take a nap. You know?
Most of her friends are dead.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Like, really, most of her friends are dead. Yeah. So, and then she laughs and accepts. But...
She has to complain
first.
Okay, so we're going way slower than I thought we were going to. Okay, next one. Is not to accept money, gifts, etc. when they're sincerely offered. So these, I think they're kind of like a freedom in a way. So now you just do that. When someone offers you a gift, you take it and you take it graciously. You just say, oh, thank you. So I never... Well, I don't take it if it's something that I'm allergic to, food. But other than that, I never say no. I always just say, thank you so much. This is great. I never, like my boyfriend's mom buys me dinner or something like that. I don't try to argue and say no. I just say, thank you. This is great. Thank you. And that's it. So you just accept things when people offer to you. That's it. Because you know on the other end, if you're offering something to someone, it's just annoying when they're trying to argue with you about taking it, number one. And it kind of sucks the happiness out of the giving in a way, too. And it's just, I don't know, it's just a big waste of time. You know, just like if someone offers, okay, thank you. Someone offers to buy my coffee, oh, thank you, great. Not like, oh, no, you don't have to, no, please. You know, it's just like... Out of kindness to them, you just say, thank you. And that's it. So, exceptions are, you know, you would get attached to whatever they're giving to you. You know the person who's giving it will later regret giving it. You can say no then. You think it's stolen. If it would hurt the person financially. It would be a problem for you to have it, like accepting a gun and keeping it in your house, something like that. If you have any reason to believe it's already been dedicated to some other temple or Dharma center, then those are the exceptions you would not accept. But other than that, you know, like, people offer us things all the time. So now you just say, yes, thank you. And that's it. And it doesn't have to be like a big deal. I think it's a relief. Okay, number 7, not to give Dharma to a person who wants it. So in the root vow, the motivation is not giving out of attachment and not wanting to share it. The motivation here is laziness or anger. Okay? If you're really teaching nicely, you just put everything you can, you pour everything out there, and then you send your students on to the next step. So there's just no attachment. There's no, not no attachment, because that's the other one. But there's nothing like, oh, I'm too lazy to prepare, or I'm angry that, I don't know, whatever. I'm angry that the student's doing better than me. Something like that, maybe. Exceptions are that you're sick to teach a lesson. You know that the student's waiting to criticize you or is disrespectful. So they only came to class to be critical. And we don't really have that much anymore, but we used to. So I've seen that, and you know it may come again. You know you can't, you know that they won't get the meaning. They aren't sitting properly, which we don't follow this as much. But traditionally, it's best not, at least if you can manage it, not to lay down, not to recline during the teachings. And there's exceptions. It's different in our culture. In other cultures, it was a big disrespect to the teachings, to the teacher, to the Dharma. In our world, it's a little different, but that's some of them. You don't point your feet at the altar or at the teacher. But that one too, when I would be sitting on the floor and my knees would hurt, if you have to straighten your legs, then you just like think in your mind, like, I bow to my teacher, I bow to the teachings, that sort of thing. So you kind of like make an offering as you're doing it. And there's all these little, what are they called? Etiquette, you know, like teaching etiquette that we don't really have an example for anymore. When I used to go to Geshe Michael's teachings and Lama Marud, and when Ami was teaching all the ACI courses, we were more in touch with it, but we're not so much anymore. So if we have time, we can go over some of them. Because a lot of people in our Sangha now just don't know, because we don't have the examples of it anymore. Okay, so other exceptions. If you know that they would never catch it, and you know if you spent all night teaching them, they would never get it. You know they would freak out if you taught the subject. They don't believe or aren't interested in what you're teaching. They have deep wrong views. You know they won't follow what you teach. You think, or you know the teaching will make them worse. So there's a lot of exceptions for this one. Or they will spread the teaching to people who are not ready, especially on emptiness or the secret teachings. And Geshe Michael talked about how Ken Rinpoche, who was his teacher, he never taught them the 50 verses on Guru Yoga over all of his years of teaching. So this one's in reference to the exception that you know it would freak them out if you taught it to them. So he never taught that because it was just too heavy to teach. Okay. Number 8 is not to reach out to those who have broken their vows or done bad deeds. So basically, someone who's done this, they're the ones who need your help the most, because they're in suffering right then. So you no longer, I mean, assuming you ever have, I know I have, but you no longer turn your back on someone who's done something wrong. you just don't do that anymore, because we're all bodhisattvas. That's what we're taking these vows for. They've planted seeds and they'll suffer from those deeds in the future. And so they're in some deep sadness right now, which we all know when we've done something wrong, especially if we've broken a vow. So there's a deep sadness, and then you're compounding that by turning your back on them. So it doesn't mean that you should let it rub off on you. There are times when you're required to cut people off. But you shouldn't ignore or ostracize them. If they're evil, you must resist them, and in general, don't be influenced badly by their behavior. So you have to be strong enough to be around them and not get dragged down too. And it doesn't have to be someone who's broken their vows, as it says. It can just be someone who's done a bad deed. So there's just two exceptions. To teach a lesson, only if you're doing it out of love. And if you getting close to them alienates many other people. Okay. Next one is failing to follow the rules, which, if followed, inspire faith in other people. And this one's pretty straightforward. There's certain rules, especially examples are for with monks, eating after noon. It's well known that monks don't do that. So doing that would cause other people to lose their faith in the tradition. Just like we're talking about people drinking. So if, and it's not actually widely known. Some people think that Buddhists don't drink and some people do. But, you know, if we were in a culture where everyone thought that Buddhists took a vow not to drink and then they saw people drinking, that would affect their faith. And it affects the faith of other practitioners, too. And it goes down to anything that we do. You know, if people know that you're a Buddhist and then they see you lying, it causes people to lose their faith. And we do this with other people too. If we know they're like a practicing Christian or serious about whatever religion, and then we see them doing some wrong, then we think, oh, well, you know, that it kind of gives the religion a bad name. We don't just think, oh, that's a person doing that. It's like they're the spokesperson for whatever faith they're following. So you're trying to inspire faith in other people.
So actually, another question on that, I was thinking, like you had mentioned monks not being or not supposed to eat afternoon. I was thinking we would give food offerings to Geshe Lama when he was here in the evenings. So I'm just kind of wondering if that's in a way breaking or encouraging him to break his vow?
I don't think so.
Because he's not supposed to eat it, but we're putting it out there for
him. Yeah, I think it's different. Number one, in some situations, I believe it's different if it's offered. But also, I don't know if that vow is the same when you're not in the monastery. I don't know how that works. And so I think he would, I mean, he'll take care of his right. vows, but you know, it's good to not be, you know, like trying to get someone to break their vows too. So I see what you're saying.
But it would be more appropriate to think of, you know, like a liquid offering or, you know, something that's different than
we
have.
We could just dump all the food into a blender.
And I don't
talk about chocolate instead of, you know, yeah. chocolate cookies or something. I'm just... It was just a thought that came to my mind.
Yeah, I think we could probably ask Venerable Tenzin about that. She might know more about the monk's vows.
Has he ever
made
the offerings?
I've seen him nibble a couple
of
times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's not like chowing down for
no,
sure.
No.
Yeah.
But he lives a lot more, I believe he's like a lot more active, and so he might be starving by the time we're eating. I don't know.
I don't know. For dinner too, right?
Yeah.
Earlier in the day, yeah.
Dinner. It wasn't earlier.
He offered a sincere invitation.
Right.
So.
If it's sincerely offered,
Yeah, I don't know all the monks' vows, and I don't know how they all work.
And then I think there's another vow that's coming up that says that if it's to benefit others, that you're almost supposed to break, or you can break a vow if it's for the benefit.
Because accepting the offering.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So this one is performing deeds which are only of lesser benefit for all living beings. So you take all the rules that the Buddha made, which are the prescribed rules. Prescribed rules are those made up in response to an event, like someone got crazy drinking, and so he made up the no intoxicant vow. And then there's the natural rules, which are the same throughout the world, like don't kill, don't steal, that sort of thing. So this one is talking about the prescribed rules, the ones that the Buddha made up in response to an event. I'm trying to skim because we have 3 minutes and we're only on about 10. So basically, here's the example. A monk's not allowed to own a piece of cloth that he doesn't intend to make into a robe within 10 days. That's one vow for monks. So this rule was made to keep monks from getting busy, going out and shopping for cloth, having to have somewhere to store it, trying to keep other people out of the place they're storing it, that sort of thing. But as a bodhisattva, you're not allowed to restrict your activities. You break your bodhisattva vow if you do restrict your activities. So if you're a bodhisattva, you go out and you buy warehouses of cloth to give to people that need it, and you keep it until the time comes to give to them. So it looks very different keeping your bodhisattva vows. So you break your vows if you're very dogmatic and you say, I'm a monk and I can't keep cloth for more than 10 days. Instead of keeping it longer and then sending it to India to help people or wherever you're sending it. So a bodhisattva vow, a bodhisattva keeps their vows very strictly, but prescribed rules must be broken if it benefits others, which are the ones that the Buddha made up in response to an event. So those vows shouldn't restrict you from helping others. So a bodhisattva, a lay person like all of us, is always out there trying to do things for people, trying to feed people, taking care of them, that sort of thing. And it's also, so it's hard. You have to be careful with these vows because you can easily go over the line of trying to help people to just, this is what I want to do. So you kind of have to judge. So if you don't break the first 7 vows of morality, when an extraordinary circumstance requires, you break the bodhisattva vow. So the first 7 are killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle talk. So if you don't break these in an extraordinary circumstance, then you break this vow. For this vow to apply, there's all these things. You have to be a bodhisattva who for trillions of years has perfected your practice. You have an extraordinary insight into when it is necessary to do something strange or unusual to help others. You must possess ultimate great compassion. And you must have kept your vows perfectly. So for this vow to apply to you, all of those need to apply to you. So basically, if you seem to be who you are, I know who I am. This is a vow that you don't have to worry about. in a sense. Okay? Because we're not going to be doing it. So it's just when it comes up in your book, you can rejoice that you didn't do it, basically.
Can you give me an example of this breaking this vow?
Yep, there's the story of the Buddha who's on a ship, and he knows that there's a murderer on the ship who's going to murder all the people on the ship. And so out of compassion for the murderer, or the would-be murderer, because he knows what terrible karmic seeds he's going to plant, the Buddha kills that person. And so the only way you can do that is if you have the skill to send their consciousness to a higher realm. That's the only way that you can do that. And so he did it out of perfect love. And he saved that person from going to the hell realms. It wasn't to save those other people. It was for that person.
Mm-hmm.
For the person who was going to do the deed. So there can be no hatred for them. He just loved him with all of his heart and was willing to do that negativity in order to save him, which then actually plants a really good seed for him.
Okay. What does it mean to send them to a higher, for me, if I stumble upon that kind of situation?
Well, do you have the ability to send someone's consciousness to a higher realm?
That's actually my question.
So then you don't... I don't have that ability either. I don't have that ability either. So in that situation, you wouldn't be able to break that vow of not killing.
And you would know if you had the ability. So if you don't know, then you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so I wouldn't know that this guy is going to murder.
You probably wouldn't. I mean, if you did know, then of course you would try to stop it. Yeah. But that's just the example that's given. So that's the traditional example that's given for that vow.
Alright.
Mm-hmm.
So I once heard Lama Mi she said that if you die fighting for your country, you are reborn in a higher place, right? But when you're at war, you are using a weapon or something. How does that,
I haven't heard anybody say that. I'm not saying that she didn't say that, but I've never heard anybody say that. So I don't know how that would work.
Okay.
Yeah. Unless you're a Buddha and you're doing something out of a higher, or maybe, like a high-level bodhisattva, and mm-hmm. you're doing something that is different than what it appears to be in some way.
I'll ask her, because she said that once. I'm not sure where or when.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's 8:34, but we'll go really fast.
I'm sorry, yeah.
It's okay. This one is straightforward. Being engaged in wrong livelihood. Okay, so examples of this. Well, it includes flattery, hinting, harassment, or any activity which is harmful to another person. So someone wants to sell you something and they say how attractive you are and how great your outfit is. That sort of thing. And the exception is if you're struggling to get out of that profession, then you don't break the vow. So you can think of harmful occupation would be trading in animals, alcohol, weapons, a butcher, those sorts of things. And then... the last one is being wild or frivolous, just wasting your time and not being serious. The exception is if you're struggling to stop and you can't control yourself. If it's to stop another's grief or depression, to lead another from a bad deed, to create a better environment for people, or to attract people to Buddhism who wouldn't otherwise come. Okay, so that could be what we were talking about with Trungpa. Number 14 is to tell others that they need to delay reaching nirvana in order to help others. So this one, we know that we can best help others by reaching nirvana or enlightenment. That sort of idea. 15, sorry to go over, is not to address rumors about yourself. Not to clear your name with the motivation to prevent others from collecting negative karma by criticizing a bodhisattva. So maybe you're just angry and you don't feel like correcting someone, but now you have to with this vow. And then lastly, not to correct others, even if it must be done forcefully. So you don't get hung up on what others are going to think of you. If you know you need to do something, you just do it with the motivation of love for someone else. So this one I think we could take in a wrong way. So we can, we'll revisit that these last few next week and see if there's any questions, because we're already over and I don't want to go any longer. Jenny's got a lot of writing to do over there. So just relaxing the body and letting all of any drop of wisdom sink in. And then from your heart, making a dedication, offering all of this merit to reaching full awakening in this life for the sake of others, as Jenny leads us in the prayers.
Sashi
Puki Chukshing Meto Tram Rirabling Shinian Degyan Padi Sange Shingdu Mikte Uargi Chokun Amdak Shingla Chuparshuk Hiram Guru Radna Mandalakam Niryatayami
Giwa
Di Giwa Kun Sunam Yeshe Sok Sok Shing Sunam Yeshe Lejumwe Dampa Kuni Toparshuk